This is the March 6th, 2018 statutory interpretation class. And remember last week, we wrapped up theory. We talked about what were the general schools of thought that govern the way judges approach statutory interpretation. And we talked about the rise of new textualism from soft textualism and how it was a reaction to a prior purpose-driven interpretation of statutes. And how there is also another school that has risen up in terms of pragmatism, taking a different approach to that. And we use the case of Stanley Marshall, the great debate between Easterbrook and Posner, dealing with our hapless LSD dealer, which is an odd thing to say, but I think it's appropriate here. The key things there was that was a case focusing on how the language could be interpreted in a way that seems odd facially, where dealers faced mandatory sentences that were extraordinarily high based on the fact that LSD was sold on water vapor that weighed more than the drug, which meant that the dealers who sold the pure stuff got minimum sentences, the guys who handed it out at parties or in gelatin got major sentences. And basically, Easterbrook's response was, that's fine. The text drives the conclusion. And here, there was a plain meaning to the rule that he could read from the four corners of the statute, and that other factors built into the way the statute was structured made it clear, including, for example, the difference in treatment between PCP and other drugs, that they didn't use a similar type of language for LSD, including the fact that he knew, without citing why, how he knew, that drugs get cut all the time, so that Congress must have been aware that a similar type of cutting process would take place. He was willing to see the language through to its end, even if it seemed to have a harsh result, but that it was his job as the faithful agent of Congress to carry it through. Posner, who interestingly enough, reached the very same conclusion in an earlier district court opinion, actually came to the opposite conclusion this time around. And his perspective was that you could not look at the overall statute and take a pragmatic approach that really focused on what the statute was supposed to accomplish and stick to a doctrinaire, literalist interpretation of the language itself. You had to look more widely. And from that pragmatist perspective, which is not wedded to any particular accident or any particular one approach beats all the others, came to the conclusion that you had to read the word in the statute to exclude things such as carriers, the car that the drugs were in. In his mind, the water vapor was just like an airplane. That's why it came to the country. It's not part of the drug. So those are the three schools we talked about. And then at that point, I made you the dark promise that we would turn away from philosophical matters and start talking about the actual rules, the actual canons today. As a parting thought, I offer it to you to each do your own spectrum of sort of a rising level of abstraction and figure out where you would put those schools and theories in so you'd have a way to hang the canons that are getting ready to come at you into a coherent framework. So with that, I'll take a deep breath. Any questions about the things we talked about Tuesday and Thursday of last week, as we did our final lap on the grand philosophy of semiotics and statutory interpretation? Okay? Because now, what I'd like to do is turn to the actual canons themselves. Now, in that regard, I want to offer you a few opening thoughts, which is, this is where a lot of students, frankly, lose heart. And I can see why. We're about to go through a list of canons. And it seems easy to mix and match the canons to get virtually any result you want. And that it's easy to then become essentially a bit nihilistic about the whole enterprise. To just essentially say, well, so it's just who your client is. Why is it there's no real truth behind all this? It's just a stack of canons that we deploy as we want to. And we'll talk more about that. The bottom line here for me is that it's not just a hodgepodge. The theories help give you a sense of what's going on. And I want to give you the overriding thought that every single judge will tell you this, including our two judges on Thursday, that when you read a statute, there's 80% of the time, there's an answer that's clear. And the canons can help make it clear to you. The harder cases in that remaining 20% is when you start deploying the canons and seeing which ones take effect. And there's even a rough hierarchy among the canons, which ones have more influence and power compared to others. But with that in mind, I just wanted to sort of remind everybody that we're, as we go walking through each of the canons, that there is still a big picture behind all of this. Having said that, I invite you to turn to the Appendix 6 in your books. Page, I believe, 1091. There are literally hundreds of canons in rough categories of varying degrees of lineage, of age, of complexity. The appendix is one of the best compilations I've seen of a short, punchy list of the canons that you can refer to make your arguments. But notice, it does still categorize them. There are different schools of canons that come into play at different times. It also roughly gives you a sense of which ones are most important. For example, the very first one is plain meaning. That is your ace. That is the one that almost always will predominate over other canons if the plain meaning is there and clear on the page. So, with that in mind, I'm going to do something here. It's a bit of an experiment. We are getting ready to go through a voyage of the canons. I'll be honest with you, this is the part where you start perhaps maybe a little dry. So, to make it more interesting, I have something for you. This is also on the webpage now. This is one of the, I think if not the, most recent opinion written by Justice Sotomayor. Now, you may recall when Justice Sotomayor was here, remember what she said about Latin maxims, the use of Latin in her opinions? Anyone? Was it just a throwaway line? She said, never. Good writing, learning to write from her perspective, and then making it clear and making it understandable to someone without abstract or old or rare terms. So, as a result, I have trimmed out her opinion, where she does related statutory interpretation analysis, where she uses the canons we're going to talk about today, but she doesn't name them. It's an Easter egg hunt. What I'm going to do is hand this out. You guys can take a look as we're going through the canons. Just peg the ones you think are worthwhile. I'll give you a few minutes as well at the end of class if you want to go through and circle the ones. And just that might be a way for you to get a sense of the operational function of some of these canons. I'll be honest with you. Don't worry that there's one right answer. I think there are some of these where her description could fit maybe one or two different canons. The bottom line here is I want you to get a sense of how they're playing behind the curtain here. So with that, let's start at the beginning. Yes. Judges use canons to interpret statutes. Canons are a motley and unruly crew, but they fall roughly into three categories, as your book describes. Textual, actual small-scale surgeon scalpels that go into the way words are structured and the way statutes bury meaning and the way they organize the information they present. They are meant to be content neutral. It doesn't matter what statute you're looking at. The text will always, under this school of thought, play by the same rules. The second broad category are substantive canons, and they do care. They put a thumb on the scale in favor of certain values, such as federalism, such as protecting, avoiding the need to get into constitutional questions, such as giving fair notice to criminal defendants. Now notice, those are substantive values. They aren't necessarily pegged to any particular school or outcome. So in that sense, they're still to a little bit value neutral. But nonetheless, they do care about the substance that's in play. The last one is called extrinsic, which basically it means anything outside of the statute. Even if you're a textualist, you are willing to go outside the letter of the law of the statute you're looking at if there's valid, reliable information you can turn to that will help you interpret terms.
in particular, for example, other statutes, which also have their own plain textual meaning.
Common law terms, which have a long, rich historical meaning that may not be apparent to the man on the street, but will be very clear to anyone who's understanding the purpose of the statute and the way it's meant to be applied in this particular setting.
So those are the big three. Now we're going to zoom in.
We're going to talk about just the first school today. We're going to talk about textual canons. In that regard,
by the way, for those of you who opted out today,
I'm going to do something which will be hard for me to do. I'm not going to take an opt-out today, mainly because there's no case today. Everything in the book we're going to talk about is common sense.
So, if anyone cares to volunteer, even without reading, this is a free day to do it.
If anyone gets called on and hasn't read it, I will be extraordinarily kind and gentle and help guide you to that inner light that Plato talks about, where you will understand what's going on even without laying eyes on the text.
So you get an extra opt-out to burn. All right, guys? If anyone wants to object, speak now. Okay. So, with that in mind, if you look on the website, and the website will cooperate, we have a PowerPoint to sort of walk through these. Okay.
So I couldn't resist this picture, which actually I have a copy of Lear Not. This photograph, this lithograph showed up in a farmer's almanac from about 1867. So weird stuff pops up wherever you don't expect it. Bottom line here is that this is the thick grammarian's portion of the class. Thick grammarian spectacles. Y'all remember where that line came from? Bonus points? This is even swag worthy if anyone would know.
Rick is thinking hard. She's almost got it, but no. All right. Okay. That was Justice Stevens in West Virginia University versus Casey, where he was taking the wood to Scalia. All right?
So, that is not a final exam type question. I'm not going to do that today. I just was curious because I love that phrase. It captures the spirit of a lot of people's objections to textualism.
So, I've already talked about the broad categories. What we're going to talk about now is the linguistic textual canons. And essentially, in my mind, the linguistic ones are the grammar ones. They're the small scale ones. And I'm going to throw in whole act and whole code on top of that. Now, the key thing here is that we're going to talk about these, but I want you to keep in mind the general strategy, and this is also a final exam strategy.
It is almost always the safe way to tackle a textual interpretation question and make sure you get most of it, which is you start small with the text itself.
Start with the word itself. Picture the sentence that's at issue.
Start with the term that's ambiguous, go out into the sentence, go out to the paragraph, go out to the section, go out to the whole act, go out to the whole code. Then at that point, you're starting to bump up against substantive issues that underplay the text itself, and then extrinsic.
So in a way, you're kind of working your way up that spectrum we talked about. So this is very much on the narrow part of that band we're going to focus on today. So yes, there will be some Latin. Couldn't resist. There has to be some Latin. We're going to go ahead and start with the justum generis, which basically means of the same kind. I want to make sure I go back here. I actually skipped over probably the most important thing.
Notice I'm just going straight to linguistics and the canons here. I missed our very first one in the appendix, didn't I? What's the most fundamental canon of all? The one that trumps all the others, erasing the whole?
Who? Sorry?
Plain meaning.
And everyone said at the same time, so I can't give out any swag for that one. So sorry, guys.
Absolutely. Plain meaning. That is where you always start.
But it's not the same thing. There's some subtleties packaged into that. Ordinary meaning is presumably what Congress uses.
Ordinary meaning can factor into plain meaning, but plain meaning can be more. Plain meaning, for example, can include statutory definitions
that may not be what the man on the street or the woman on the street would expect. For those of you who have bent in this direction, for example, take a look at what the term qualified plan means under ERISA. It is mind-bendingly complex, even though it sounds like it should be fairly straightforward. In addition to statutory definitions, there are technical definitions. And I can't resist harking back to one that haunted me my first 2 years as an associate. What is the meaning of solid waste, quote unquote? Sounds easy, doesn't it? Believe it or not, the way the statute defines it includes gas. It includes things that you would actually reuse and haven't thrown away. So it gets, again, very technical and complex, but it's a technical term. It's not just what the standard ordinary meaning might be. And then last, common law. I mentioned it previously. I just wanted to warn you, common law pops up in unexpected ways. For example, there may be a rich history behind a term that otherwise might have a facially straightforward meaning. Statute of limitations, or SG. I'm curious, have you guys talked about SG yet in property? Awesome. That's one of my favorite words. It's like win Scrabble every time. Okay? So, just want to make sure we didn't forget that. The one part of the reasons I wanted to mention is because it does come into the one case that is sort of talked about in our textbook today. And since it's only sort of talked about, I'll just flag it for you. But Nix v. Headed. A Supreme Court case, believe it or not, on what the meaning of the word tomato means. Tomato? Tomato? I don't know. Bottom line, the Supreme Court was faced with a decision as to whether or not a tomato is a fruit or a vegetable. I am curious, how many of you think tomato is a fruit? All right, how many of you think it's a vegetable? It's about even, a little bit in favor of fruit, a little bit in favor of vegetable. I'm sorry, what do I hear over here? Technically speaking?
Technically,
cereal is a soup.
Technically, but that's ridiculous.
No, that's such a terrible take.
The sad thing is, I'm tempted to start debating with it whether it's a soup or a mixture, but I'm going to resist.
That's what a hot dog is.
All right. I can tell this conversation is steering off into dark places right away. Very quickly.
So, are you saying that plain meaning is actually a fourth category of
the
sexual canon, or that it falls under
the fourth category? I think, in fairness, it could be included as one of the textual canons, but it's so fundamental, it's almost an canon. It's the one I'd start with. Okay? I thought I saw another. Okay. Nix v. Headed. The point here is that if it was a fruit, there was a different import tax imposed as opposed to whether it was a vegetable. Money was involved. And the Supreme Court was faced with a decision down below where the court actually heard testimony from experts on whether or not it was a fruit or a vegetable. And the experts basically were awash. They then turned to the dictionary, and the dictionary wasn't terribly helpful either. Then ultimately, it came to the point, and this is the thing I wanted to flag for you, the thing that actually underlies the decision's rationale that drove its conclusion was the judge didn't rely on the dictionary, didn't rely on prior certificate. He looked on judicial notice. Have y'all talked about judicial notice in CivPro yet? Essentially, judicial notice means it's so obvious even judges know it. And they can simply assume it's true without evidence, without testimony, without any documentation. So the judge simply said the dictionary is a tool to assist the judge in exercising judicial notice as to what is a fruit versus what is a vegetable. And the judge basically said to anyone who has any common sense at all, tomatoes are a vegetable. That's the context of being used for importation purposes of the common categorization of that plant. Now, botanically speaking, the two-thirds of the class, you guys were absolutely correct. And the Supreme Court says, that's right. It is technically a fruit. It contains its seeds within itself. But nonetheless, bottom line, for custom purposes, if you were to look at it, it is essentially not going to be put next to the bananas. It's going to be put next to the beans. It's not a fruit. It's a vegetable for purposes of customs. Does that make sense for everybody? And that's sort of not a canon, is it? It's not a general principle. It's essentially that plain meaning again. That sort of root, first canon that starts everything off. And by the way, small side note, notice no legislative history discussion at all. Not much help there. Of course, this is a very old case, so it's kind of before legislative history really came to the fore. Any questions before we actually get to our canons? Okay. I promised you a justum generis, Latin for of the same kind. Essentially, if I have a list of items that are specific, and then at the end of the list, I have a broad catch-all term, it is fair game to take a look at the meaning of the smaller, narrower terms to define the scope of the end broad term. I know that sounds a little bit opaque, but think of it this way. Essentially, this is your bucket list. This is your bucket term canon. If I say, for example, a long list of very specific things and then say, and anything else, I clearly don't mean the entire sum total of the universe's matter. I'm talking about anything else of the same type as the preceding list of specific items. So, you know, for example, suppose we had a statute that was meant to govern the marketing of organic food. And the organic food statute said, however, we are not going to regulate things such as salt, comma, pepper, comma, or other any other seasoning, period. Now, I'll ask you, just offhand, would that include MSG? How many of you love Chinese food? Yeah. Who's offended that not every hand is up right now? So I assume you weren't volunteering, but I'll go ahead and ask anyway, since there's no opt-out today. Would MSG be included?
I don't think I know enough about MSG.
It's a chemical compound that is manufactured specifically to enhance a savory undertone in certain foods.
Powder?
Yeah. It's a chemical powder, basically. Even it's in the organic food statute.
All food is made chemically, maybe not organic.
All right. I've saved you, Horatio, from traipsing into realms philosophical. I'm throwing you a life preserver. A justum generis. Salt, pepper, and other seasonings would imply that salt and pepper are naturally grown, available substances that you pluck from the bounty of nature and would be within the meaning of the organic statute, or organic food statute. MSG, I think there'd be a lot of folks who wear Birkenstocks and hemp one shirts who'd be very upset to find out that the organic produce had MSG sprinkled on top of it.
I
don't
understand that.
Okay. But you sound like there's a reservation lurking under the surface.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I was the one that didn't think that cigarettes would fall under the FDA.
I will beg your indulgence, since we have many a canon to go before we get to the end of this road today. I'd ask you to save Rabbi Williamson for perhaps a discussion towards the end. And I have to say, I'm quite pleased to remember that part back. So it's encouraging. It's sticking. I appreciate it. Okay, so a justum generis. By the way, someone told me that Latin's actually a justum generis. And I was like, no way. So, I'm fine with the justum generis. Hopefully you guys are too. All right, any questions about this one? Next up, our other dose of Latin today, nascitur associis. If you look at that one, going back to your old days of SAT and LSATs, God forbid, just looking at context, this one gives you little hints as to what it's about. Essentially, associus implies social.
What this basically means is that you know a word by its compatriots. This is a fairly broad canon. Essentially, if I have a list of two or more items, and they all share a common quality, and then I have a broad term plopped in the middle somewhere, or a narrower term that could be interpreted maybe broadly or narrower, I look to its feathered companion, that was it, birds of a feather flock, its companions, to interpret the meaning of that word in juxtaposition with the others. Now, I will save some heartache. A lot of people get concerned about to what extent adjustum and nociter overlap with each other. And the short answer is, yeah, they do. So for our class purposes, and I think you'll find most people who do this in front of judges, adjustum tends to be saved for that bucket list term where you have a long list and then there's a big catch-all at the end. Nociter is more flexible. They can cover virtually any list, any compilation of terms. So to give you an example, there is a famous case in Minnesota where the Minnesota Supreme Court was faced with a statute which made it a criminal offense, if I remember right, a felony offense, to have a loaded gun in your car. The only exception was, quote, unless that gun is contained in a closed and fastened case, gun box, or securely tied package, close quote, period. Well, one woman was arrested and convicted because she had a pistol. I think probably inside, maybe like a little Lady Derringer, tucked inside of her purse. The purse was clasped shut and set on the floor behind the passenger seat of her car. Now, if you're using nociter, is there anything in common between closed and fastened case and gun box and securely tied package that make it extensible to a purse, just snap shut? How many think she should be doing time? Well, let me rephrase that. How many think that she is guilty under the terms of the statute as written? Jack says, yes. You're dressed like a prosecutor today, so
that's no, Grant's not a prosecutor. I'm friendly.
I tell you, the environmental prosecutor wears green ties. I'm sorry. Do you also have your hand up?
Yeah.
Okay. You think so too? Okay. So everyone else thinks she got a bum deal? All right. Just to bench your intuitions, to give you some comparison, the Minnesota Supreme Court said, sorry, she does time. There was not enough of a commonality in those terms to make it clear that a securely tied package or a closed and fastened case can be extended to a purse which is merely just snapped shut. It actually has to have some sort of lock that prevents access. And so there you go. Nociter cuts both ways. It's not necessarily always going to be the light of the sun shining down to save you at the end of the day. So with that, notice there's a very sneaky trap door built in the bottom here. They have to have a common quality. You have to be able to persuade a court what that common quality is. Think back to our friends in Holy Trinity and the terms involved there. Did an entertainer, did a lecturer include an ordained minister? It depends on what common feature you found in the preceding list of other occupations that were excluded. And if you were to argue, for example, that it included only people who entertain the public, it doesn't include our minister. But if it includes people who do not work manual labor, it does give some relief to our minister. So you have to be able to discern what that term is. There is a handful of cases that basically say sometimes these lists just don't have a common term. They're just catch-alls. They're hodgepodge, in which case nociter cannot be invoked to help your client. All clear so far? Yes.
Practically speaking, if the list has more than one common feature, then it's up to the attorney to try to find the most persuasive common feature that supports their side to use the tool, but the tool can work both ways.
Absolutely. That's an extraordinarily good comment. There's no reason why a list can only have one term, one commonality to it. You've got 2, 3, 4, 5. The question is you have to find which one takes primacy in the case that you have before you. Yeah.
Then the last, oops, I forgot. So nociter. Now the last of the Latins. And that's, I hope that wasn't someone popping their knuckles. That'd be really bad. What? You've totally blown my train of thought now. All I'm thinking now is I wish I had a piece of gum now too. I'm sorry, Drew, what?
So, at Houston, is when we had like an extra catch-all term at the end, it says I get all of their blah, blah, blah. And then Gnosticism is when we have a specific enumerated term that we need more description for, or more interpretation for.
Exactly. Now, that means Gnosticism, to a way you could argue, includes Hujustum as a subset.
Sure.
But roughly, that's exactly right. Okay? Any other questions? Okay, the last one. This is the big three. Expressio Unius. We've already seen this beastie before. If Congress lists or legislature lists things and doesn't include something on that list, it meant to exclude it. Silence has content. So, that means when you're reading a statute and you have that long, exhaustive pain that hurts your eyes to read list, the failure to include your client's matter can be devastating, unless you can find some other way to interpret one of the other terms on the list broadly to incorporate your client. Now, having said that, it requires some sort of sense of commonality among the list, but bottom line here is that it assumes Congress acts rationally and intentionally in choosing words that it uses in coming up with a dictate. I'll be honest with you. I'm not sure I buy that. Do you? I mean, those of you who've worked in the legislature before, those of you who've talked in this class, you know there's a lot of irrationality baked into the legislative process. Things get thrown at the last minute, logs get rolled, deals get cut, funding gets shifted. As a matter of empirical reality, this may not hold a lot of water, right? Here's what I'm going to tell you. It doesn't matter. This is a legal doctrine that is meant to enhance the coherence of our interpretation of statutes. It serves a different purpose. It's not meant to be scientifically accurate. It's meant to serve a higher purpose or goal of presenting an interpretation that makes sense to people reading a statute. That's predictable, that's clear. So, any questions so far about any of these three? Because here's the punchline. I guarantee you, these three are the ones you will deal with in your careers. These three will show up in the final exam questions. These three will pop up in briefs you write and arguments you make. They may not be called this, but these three concepts are the big engines that drive most statutory interpretation cases. So it's worth understanding the concepts even if Latin gives you a rash. All right? So any question about those three before we sort of march along? Let me give you a few more variations.
Here's a question.
Oh, I'm sorry. There is a question. I'm sorry. I was barreling along.
Can I clarify with the first two? Do you have to have the general catch-all to avoid those, or if there's just a list, can you assume, like, is that the argument that you're assuming? Does that question make sense?
I think
so. If the statute reads X, Y, Z, period,
right,
can you argue under the first two?
Just a generis usually means that you have to have a general, broad term you're trying to clarify and narrow down. Not sure if you have both of those. So if you just have a list that doesn't have a bucket term at the end, you're probably employing Oscar. Does that make sense?
Yes.
Any others?
All right. So, a few more specific variations on this. If you have a general prohibition, thou shalt not wear sneakers in class, and it says, except for Nikes. The general assumption here is that that exception to a general prohibition is all you get. This one has a special bite of expressiveness. Too bad for you Reebok owners, all right? It's the idea that Congress intentionally wrote a broad prohibition and then specifically cookie cut it out only exactly what it wanted to protect. Second, if it requires action to be formed in a particular way, That means that if there's another way to do it, you're out of luck. This one haunts a lot of fields of practice, particularly financial, particularly immigration, particularly environmental, where you can get a lot of ways to skin a cat. But if Congress says you have to use one particular way, they've excluded all the other possibilities. It sounds a little bit irrational and bad policy, but that's the way the doctrine's evolved over the years. And then last, any specific provisions on preemption means that any other means of preemption are off the table. That one sounds a little more obscure. I'll simply note that some federal statutes spell out exactly what Congress wants to preempt. And those provisions can be very complicated. But the point is, once Congress speaks that that's what's preempted, all the other stuff that might have been generally preempted is not. They're safe. They're off the table. Does that make sense for everybody? Congress, by speaking, tailors the power of preemption only the way that it specifies. You can't pull other stuff in.
Professor?
Yes.
A question about expressio unis. Is there ever a situation where it can be somewhat ambiguous? Because just to use your example about Nikes, I know just an example, but
yeah.
The fact that you said only Nikes, and I thought to myself, you know, Nike has subsidiaries like Converse, so would that exclude, you know, Converse? Or
I think that's a marvelous question, and the really honest answer is I don't have any clue.
Well, I know that was just an example.
I like it, though.
I was relating to how possibly maybe a situation where an exclusion is within a statute, but someone thinks, well, that also not include or include this situation.
I unfortunately would have to say if you were in front of me and I was a judge, I would throw you onto this process we've been talking about. All we have is the word Nike. So I'd say, you'd say, but that includes Converse. I'd say, prove it to me. Show me where in the text of the statute it says anything that could be construed broadly enough to include them. And I'd be honest with you, unless you could find some other part of the statute that makes it clear, or the statute works illogically, like for example, let's say like 99% of all Nike sold are actually going to be Converse. You're in a position where you're going to be hard pressed by the standing prior general rule that the expressio unius is meant to only to specify exactly. Sorry, I'm wrestling with the words here because it's convoluted. Bottom line is the presumption that you're wrestling with is the field is tilted against you. If Congress only said Nike, that means if it didn't say Converse too, or it didn't define Nike elsewhere in the statute to include subsidiaries, you're out of luck, unless you can persuade the court that something else in the statute gives you a back door, or there's some other legislative history to clarify an ambiguous term. Does that help?
Yeah.
All right, any other questions? That was a good one. You can tell because of the length of the answer I gave. All right. Okay, so those are the big three. So to kind of operationalize them for you, because let's face it, just talking about abstract doctrine it's kind of hard to stay focused after a while, isn't it? I wanted to give you an example from a case that actually was one I had to tangle with. Sarbanes-Oxley. How many of you are interested in doing securities law or corporate law? All right, so we got a few. I didn't know that. Okay. Any others? Are y'all familiar with Sarbanes-Oxley, what it is? Generally? This is the Enron statute. This is the one that was designed to prevent future meltdowns and financial fraud. One of the key things about the statute is that it drastically upped the penalties for destroying evidence. I will tell you, in the same building I worked in, Pinswell Place, downtown, Arthur Anderson had his offices. And there were allegations that shredding had taken place of records related to Enron over the weekend. Side note. At the advice of inside counsel. We'll save that ethics lesson for another day. So in response, Congress basically said these penalties are too light because we cannot prosecute these huge economy-destroying crimes unless we have the evidence to go after them. So they said, it's a felony. And drastically increased the terms if you destroy any record, document, or tangible object. And this is word straight from the statute. Seems pretty straightforward, right? It's not just paper. if I'm destroying anything else that physically encapsulates the information needed to build the case, that is the same thing as if I put it through a shredder. Everyone feeling okay so far? Make sense? Because it quickly gets weird. Criminal prosecution, this is a ship floating in the Gulf of Mexico. The ship is required by federal law to have a tank to capture waste oil, which is stored here to be pumped out when it lands back home and docks at the bay. Right, here's the ship channel. And you can see the pipes going down and pumping the oil into the giant vessel. What's the difference between the first picture and the second picture? What, Patrick?
It's bypassing.
You have to say a little louder.
It's bypassing the pump.
Bypassing? See this piece of pipe here? It's gone. The captain directed the crew to go in and weld, to basically cut the pipe and put a hose in. Guess where this hose went to?
Ocean.
That's right. Right off the side of the boat. Here was the question. The captain then told the crew to throw away that pipe. Get rid of it. The penalty for the actual discharge was relatively light. It was 5 times greater penalty for throwing away the pipe because it was viewed as a Sarbanes-Oxley violation, financial fraud statute to be applied to a boat in the Gulf of Mexico. All right, so far so good. Y'all getting a feeling for how the statute may sort of wander outside the pen you put it in to start? Because it gets weirder. Also, Gulf of Mexico. Are there fishermen in the class, mentions? Or fishers, I should say, fishermen. Mike, do you recognize the species?
No.
Redfish.
It's a what?
Redfish. Kind of. Well.
Sorry, a mutation.
A mutation of one, perhaps. Here's the thing. This is a fish that is under federal protection, and you can only catch it if it exceeds a certain size. Explain the ruler at the bottom. A captain was caught in the middle of a fisher boat with a haul that included way too many juvenile of these fish. So the got written up and said, "Come straight to the side of the your berth dock, and we want to take these fish from you, and you know hold on to them." So what happened as soon as the boat sped away with the Coast Guard? You guys know, what's human nature in this situation? Fly away, little fishies. And they were gone. When they got in, there was a mysterious drop in the number of juvenile fish. And the captain said, I don't know, maybe you miscounted the first time around. That didn't go over very well. So as a result, criminal prosecution, felony conviction, and again for the same basis, Sarbanes-Oxley. It was a destruction of evidence to let the fish go. Now, here's the question. If you're in that situation, what of the statutory tools do we have that might help if you're trying to defend our friend who runs the boat?
Sorry, I saw this movie way too many times when my kids are growing up. I will not try to do it again for you, I'm sorry. So, which of the three seems the most likely? There's no penalty for mispronouncing. Go for it.
Adjustum generis.
Awesome! Adjustum. And why is that?
Because the tangible object is sort of like the catch-all.
Okay.
And we need to narrow it based on like record or document instead of like fish or pipe.
So a record and a document share a common quality of being an actual medium of transmission of information. It doesn't have to be paper, it can be a document. But that's their essence. A fish doesn't qualify. Absolutely. And that is how our captain walked. You've made the exact winning argument. I think Ruth Bader Ginsburg wrote the decision. So, see, there you go. Now, those are the big three. Don't forget the other smaller ones. And these are ones, frankly, I'll be honest with you, they're really not legally hugely deep. They're just good writing. I hope you guys follow these anyway. I'm sorry, go ahead.
What about the expressio unis?
Mm-hmm.
Because the statute doesn't say anything about just losing or leaving the fish.
Well, you say since he didn't destroy the fish?
Just destroy or alter or tamper with the fish?
Possible, but I see mischief in that interpretation. Hey, suppose I have a box of documents. I don't shred them. I don't destroy them. I just take them to the bus station downtown and leave it next to the Greyhound.
Or I, you know, there are parts of the library so deep and accessible no one ever goes. I just put them there. I don't destroy them, but effectively they're gone for prosecutorial purposes. I see your argument. And that'd be more of a Nociter argument, wouldn't it? But, no, you said unius, though.
Well, I mean, the Nociter argument is that all the words used in the statute are similar.
Well, I hear you. Maybe I intentionally excluded one small detail of the case. These fishies were long dead when they got tossed back in the water. So he didn't shred them, but effectively he destroyed them because they didn't swim away. They were basically part of the food chain as soon as they got back in the water. So, but I hear you. I think that's a good argument. That might be something that would be section two of your brief, but maybe not section one. Okay. Any others? Okay, so with these, let's just, you know, bottom line here, you know these. I hope you know these. The difference between may and shall. If you survive the LSAT gauntlet, you know the difference between may and shall. May is permissive. Shall is compulsory. I've seen billions of dollars turn on the choice of the word shall over may because the courts are very rigorous in saying that shall is a non-discretionary duty that must be exercised. The rules of civil procedure emphasize the same thing. They've rigorously gone through and tried to call out every mention of the word may when it should be shall and vice versa. Number two, this one's a little bit more obscure, but it will pop up. The last antecedent rule. For example, you need to bring me, if I had the phrase cow, cat, and belt with batarangs, hopefully some of you read comic books still, or watch bad TV shows, would the batarangs be applying to anything other than just the belt? Probably not. The idea there is that a descriptive qualifier at the end of a list is presumed to only apply to just the last item on the list. So that means that even if that last term could be interpreted to apply to all the items on the list, the court ain't going to go that far. They're just going to go to that last term and stop. That has big consequences. I won't go into it because I don't want us to run out of time, but you know, the Barnhart case that is talked about in the text dealing with the elevator operator who lost her job because people don't need to operate elevators anymore, but she wanted Social Security because her job was gone. And basically, Justice Thomas interpreted that provision of the statute that said that you're entitled to Social Security if you can't work and that work is not available in the general economy anymore. He interpreted it narrowly so that if there was any work available in the economy this person could do, they could qualify for Social Security even if the job they were doing no longer existed. The last antecedent limited the extension of the qualifier to just the last term in the list. Again, familiar, conjunctive versus disjunctive or typically means and or. It doesn't mean, if I say Pepsi or Coke, it doesn't mean I have to bring both. I can choose which one. And last, punctuation. This is the weakest. This is the sad person at the end of the parade. Punctuation usually doesn't carry that much weight in interpreting the statute. If you have a clear plain text argument or other canon, punctuation usually can be overridden. But if there's nothing else, punctuation can tip the scale. There's one famous case in England where a placement of a comma resulted in the imposition of the death penalty. So do pay attention. Bottom line here is that there's usually not a deadly comma. Punctuation is a guide, it's instructive, but it's the form of fairly weak evidence as to interpretation. So that's it for the linguistic canons. Notice the one I didn't talk about, and it's a choice. Notice I didn't talk about the one canon that always gets students wrapped around the axle every year, the golden rule. Did y'all see that one in the textbook and kind of go, The golden rule simply states that you will not interpret a statute in such a way that results in an absurdity. You'll try to interpret it in such a way that it accomplishes its purpose as long as it doesn't create an absurdity. Bottom line is that the golden rule is fairly narrowly applied. If you go to any judge in Texas or any judge in the federal bench and argue that the golden rule applies to your case, you will either get a blank expression or laughter. It is a historical term that is not currently carrying much punch in argument with the bench. Now, the rule against absurdity and its cousin, the Scrivener's error rule, do still exist and actually have some bite. We talked a little bit about those, but here's the takeaway. The rule against absurdity and the rule against Scrivener's errors are very rarely deployed. Judges are extremely concerned about basically saying, well, the statute can't mean what it says. This is just a mistake, it's a clerical error. Let's move this term, or actually say this date's different. Remember Locke versus U.S.? You will file your claim for your gravel mining operation before December 31st. Even Justice Marshall was not willing to go so far as to correct what seems to be a clear error on the part of Congress, the Scrivener's error. It's usually preserved for clear facial mistakes that have no other alternative interpretation. And you will file your claim by February 30th. Or file it on some sort of date that doesn't exist, like a Wednesday on a particular year that, you know, that date doesn't occur. So I just wanted to flag that for you. The book mentions it. We're not going to talk about the golden rule in this class. It may pop up, but the key thing there is that, well, really, when you say golden rule, you're really talking about an older version of the rule against absurdities. And it is true. You will try to avoid a statutory interpretation that has an absurd result. But that assumes you have an alternative that doesn't produce an absurd result. It tips the scales again. It doesn't dictate a rewrite of the statute. Okay, any questions on those linguistic textual canons? Because we have a few more to finish out our basket. Namely, outside of the sentences themselves, you also can look in the text beyond just the provisions you care about. And here we start getting into the whole act, whole rule canon, whole act rule. Again, the assumption here is Congress knows what it's doing, that it speaks with a coherent, intellectually unified voice. And as a result, every part of the statute serves a function. It has a meaning. And as a result, that meaning is meant to not result in waste. For example, the titles mean something. Remember in the Holy Trinity Church, the court invoked the title of the statute to try and interpret the terms within the statute. The general modern rule is that titles are viewed as weak evidence, but you can look to them. Preambles. Congress hereby finds that opiates are a scourge of the United States. Notice that opening provision, that preamble, that opening proviso basically doesn't have legal effect. It doesn't say you have to do anything. It doesn't define anything. But it does state what the purpose that Congress was willing to put into the statute itself. And as a result, it too can be a guide. It can help figure out what language within the statute means. And the last one's a very minor point, provisos. Thou shalt do this, provided that something else occurs. Essentially, that provided that language historically is usually interpreted narrowly because it's viewed as a sort of pre-qualifier condition within the broader requirement. I will be surprised if you guys ever have to deal with a current modern statute with a proviso written into it. It's very much out of fashion. But nonetheless, just wanted to alert you was there. Those are straightforward. they all kind of say the same thing, don't they? You can go, it's like, use the whole animal. No ear, no hoof shall go unused. Use all the statue. Now, however, you also have to make sure that you interpret in such a way that's efficient. The rule against surplusage, it's almost as important as the big three. You will see this rule pop up. I'm pretty sure it will show up on the final. It will show up in your briefs. The rule against surplusage says Congress doesn't lard up a statute with words that don't have any purpose, that just duplicate other words. Congress doesn't write statutes in a way so that one provision negates another part of the same statute and makes that language meaningless. Every word serves a purpose, and all those purposes interlock in a way so that they all achieve something unique to each word. This one is oftentimes honored in the breach because it's hard, frankly, to find meanings for multiple long lists of words where each one carries something to the party that's unique to just that word. But nonetheless, courts will use the rule against surplusage to try and find some special sauce in a word that goes beyond what the other words in the statute already say. And last, and this is, notice, not a canon, it's not a rule, it's a presumption. That means on our scale of power, it's a little bit further down from the top. This is sort of middle of the pack. A presumption of consistent usage. If I use the same word in a statute in different parts of the statute, the meaning of the word doesn't vary. It means the same thing. That seems logical, doesn't it? Just common sense. I will tell you, it's just a presumption. Congress is totally free, just like Humpty Dumpty and Alice in Wonderland, to change the meaning of a word however it sees fit, even within the same statute. And there's actually a famous Supreme Court case dealing with the Clean Air Act, where they changed the meaning of a word between two different titles of the same act. Same word, different meanings. It can be done, but the presumption, absent some clear expression of varying usage, is that they will have the same meaning going all the way through. Does that make sense? Because believe it or not, that's about it. That's your toolkit. Those are the big three rules. Those are the other textual tools. We will start going down the substantive canons after we have our special session on Thursday. But to sort of make it all real, let's be honest, this is the sort of thing where if you're just reading canon after canon after canon, you can feel your soul evaporating out of your body and rising, and you're looking down at yourself thinking, oh my God, did I choose the right career? They have real bite. They're actually fun to deploy. They're tools. So here's what I would suggest. I'm going to give you a few parting thoughts, things that I would suggest you just sort of have in mind for the big picture. But then, since our time is getting short, I would invite each of you to go ahead and take a look at that case I handed out. I've excerpted out all the language in the case, except the provisions that are the ones that go directly what we're talking about. And here's the bottom line. This is a case. I'm going to go ahead and tell you a little bit about it now, just so you'll have it in hand as I'm telling you the big windup here today. This is a case about what is water. I'm not kidding. In particular, under the Clean Water Act, there's a term called waters of the United States. And the federal government can only regulate waters of the United States, quote unquote. Well, what does that include? Does it include, for example, dry creek beds that only have water in them periodically? Does it include prairie potholes, like out in Katy, where you have water for 3 months to 4 months out of the year? Does it include areas where large bodies of birds fly through and roost? Even though there's not actual water, it's flat, muddy, marshy land. It's very high content of water. EPA tried to solve it. The Corps of Engineers tried to solve it by passing a rule that expansively interpreted all these to be water. And the Supreme Court had to wrestle with whether or not that interpretation made any sense. I've just culled out the part of Justice Sotomayor's opinion where she walks through the statutory analysis. You don't need to know the answer to the statute. I don't care whether or not you know what the Clean Water Act says, but see if you can figure out which of our tools we've talked about that she's using without telling you. Where does the plain meaning rule show up? Where does a justum show up? Where does expressio unius show up? And what I would suggest is, you know, scan that opinion, and if you see one, I realized I haven't given any swag out at all today, because I've been talking so much. You know, if someone finds one fairly quickly as I'm talking at the big finale, I'll be glad to sort of distribute swag freely here. So, looking ahead, what are the things I would tell you? Number one, these are tools, not rules. They are not meant to be rigid, they are meant to be flexible. They are meant not to be in a hierarchy, but to swap around with each other. They're things that you use to accomplish results. Second, as I mentioned before, don't get cynical. It's easy to simply say, oh, what? It just matters who hires me. The statute doesn't mean anything. It's just words. These canons are something that really don't get driven by external reality. That's just not true. There's cases with hard meaning where you have a legitimate argument what it means, but that doesn't mean that there's nothing there. And then a few big questions, things that I don't know the answers to. I don't think anyone does, but they might be things that make it interesting for you to sort of digest these canons. Number one is, where's the law? Where do these canons come from? Are they common law? Are they federal law? Are they state law? Which ones take precedence over the others? If they are inherent in the statute itself, and that Congress basically bakes them into every statute, does that mean Congress can change them? This statute will not be interpreted according to the plain meaning rule. It will only use the definitions contained in the statute. This statute will not be interpreted according to the rule of leniency. We want to be interpreted as harshly as possible. Can Congress tell a court how to interpret a statute that it's right? No one really knows. That's a fundamental question we're still wrestling with. I have my personal opinion, but I'd be curious what your guesses are. Second, does it matter who's interpreting? Is it fair to say that a Supreme Court interprets a statute one way, but a trial court can go a different path, or an agency? Can they be more flexible? Can they be more aggressive? Can they include policy where a court might not? That's when we'll come to the last part of the class. And last, and this one is a cousin to the first one. If it's a matter of state law, which a lot of people think, and states can each do it differently, what happens when states go all over the map? And some interpret statutes one way and some interpret them a different way. And then you have judgments being enforced in different states based on different rules. It sounds like an abstract question. There is a literally trillion-dollar question right now in California on climate tort liability cases. Trying to figure out how that's going to play out. So to sort of sum all this up, to try and give you a sense, I've included for just reading on the side, you know, not required reading for today, two statutes. The U.S. Dictionary Act, where Congress is saying to the courts, this is how you must interpret statutes. And the Texas Code Construction Act, which says Texas legislature telling the courts how you will interpret them. Two things. Notice how different the two are. Texas is much more liberal than the federal government in this respect. And second, I'm just curious, how many of you would think that a statute by Congress telling courts how to interpret statutes just might be unconstitutional? Emily immediately says yes. And I know she didn't say anything because her throat's still sore. Okay. yep. I'm not asking for y'all to give me a reason right now to think about it. That goes to the heart of the issue. If it's an Article III power that's inherent in the courts, maybe that's where these rules are coming from. But if so, that means state courts are Article III and administrative courts are Article III. Just a thought. So with that in mind, I know some of you are trying to operate in tandem. While I was talking, to also try and scan the opinion. Did anyone find anything that they'd point to? James?
Page 10, second full paragraph. For starters, Congress uses the phrase equitable limitation or other limitation, so there must be somewhere in time. So that's going to be, I believe, nos juris sucis, or actually, I think it would be adjusum generis, since other limitations general.
And just so you know, I wrote adjustum on the side of mine as well. Awesome. Any others? Because I have more than one. Yeah? Here is the first swag then. I have for you, David.
dated 1894, a Latin grammar textbook. May it serve you well as you do all section. All right. Last chance. Any others before class wraps up?
I'll give you a hit. Oh!
Okay, at the bottom of the button, I don't know if this is right, because I kind of thought it should be the last of the NC moments. They have the word in, you cannot expand to the phrase other limitation, but it's not going upwards, it's going down. So I don't know if that counts.
So which one would you say? Which canon would you say then?
I guess that would be the first, or the
Now, I hear you, Leah. What I would suggest is it's not that it's any affluent and they're looking for it to list this one. It's more that it says any is so broad, the United States would say it must have included these waters. So, and the court said any is not just anything. Look at the other words around it to figure out what any means. So, well, no, no, but no, it's only fair. You're on the skinny opinion. So I might suggest to you that might be Nociter instead. So I do have more here, I guess, for you. Etch-a-Sketch. I figured this seemed appropriate because a lot of people think canons just let you say whatever the hell you want to. That it's actually something more. You do have some rules as to how the knobs turn. But here you go. Last one. Any others? Ah.
On the last paragraph on page 13, the person says, beyond the right of statutory text, the government instruction also renders other than for language superfluous.
Wow. Which one is that? You got it. All right. You get the last one. And I'm curious if anyone else here knows what this is. How many of you had a chance to use one of these? Sorry?
What is
it? A hint. It's a slide rule. This is something that you actually... I brought this because in addition to the Etch-a-Sketch, I wanted to deal with the fact that this is... there's not necessarily a precision that's scientific to interpreting statutes. Also, I have to admit, this one is a fond place in my heart because we're looking at the last president of the slide rule club of Bernard Junior High. We disbanded it because calculators came out that year. So, there you go. All right, last chance. Any other questions? Okay, then remember, 5 o'clock, deadline for questions, and I'll see everybody Thursday in Crow's Hall. Who has a sign-up list?